This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Our Master Cheesemaker program is one of the only two in the world. So it's no wonder every master in America has called Wisconsin home. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with me, your host, Zara Tangora, and my amazing co-host, my mother, Bobby Conforto, who is not here for the intro, but will definitely be here for the episode. And what an episode we have today, folks. A really, really special conversation with Sarah Austin Janess and her father, Thorne Janess. Sarah is the executive producer of The Moth, which, if anyone is not familiar with The Moth is a global arts organization dedicated to the art and craft of personal storytelling. We were just really so excited to speak with Sarah and Thorne. They joined us to talk about the loss of Sarah's mother and Thorne's wife, Maureen, who passed away pretty suddenly of a very aggressive cancer in 2016. And it was a conversation we were looking forward to because, of course, as with everyone, we really wanted to hear, you know, about their loved one, about Maureen and the experiences that they had in the grieving process and their journey, their grief journey, but also in discussing storytelling, which is what we all do each week on the show. All our guests are here to share their stories, and it was really so wonderful and so interesting to have Sarah, who is, you know, the executive producer of The Moth and has been for a long time, to offer, you know, her particular expertise in terms of the intersection of grief and storytelling. And also we talked a lot about food, and Thorne and Sarah, as you'll hear in the episode, developed some really beautiful rituals around food and grief after the passing of Maureen. So thank you so much to Thorne and Sarah. This is such a great episode. Can't wait for you guys to take a listen. We also just want to mention, and we put this in the show notes and talked about it at the end of the show, but very exciting news that in April, on April 26th, The Moth book is coming out. It is called How to Tell a Story, The Essential Guide to Memorable Storytelling from The Moth. It's published by Crown Publishing, and pre-sales have begun. So go ahead wherever you buy books, hopefully from an independent bookseller, but and go ahead and order that Moth book, because The Moth is just such a wonderful resource in terms of, I mean, personally, and I know Bobby feels the same way, just in so many facets of life, storytelling and finding commonality with other people is just important in all of our journeys, and especially when it comes to grief, just feeling connected, feeling like you're not, you know, other or weird or wrong for having these feelings, and for that you're not alone in this experience. So we really encourage you to listen to the Moth Radio Hour, to check out the book and pre-order it. And yeah, please enjoy our wonderful talk with Sarah and Thorne. And we hope you're all doing well. And if you like the show, let us know. Send us an email at processing@heritageradionetwork.org if you'd like to be a guest on the show, if you have a listener letter. Also, we ask if you have time to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. It helps the show grow. It helps more people become aware of it and connect. And that that would be amazing if you have an extra moment. So take care of yourselves and each other. And without any further ado, please enjoy our talk with Sarah and Thorne. Okay, well, folks, we have an amazing episode today for so many reasons. The topic is extremely interesting and complex, and our guests are a father and daughter, which is a first for us on the show, and so cool and such an absolute pleasure to have both Sarah and Thorne Janess with us today. Sarah is the executive producer of The Moth. For anyone who has not heard of The Moth, it's amazing. And The Moth is a global arts organization dedicated to the art and craft of personal storytelling. Sarah also produces and is one of the hosts of The Moth Radio Hour and The Moth Podcast. She also co-created The Moth's Global Community Program, which develops and elevates true personal stories from extraordinary people in the global South in order to challenge dominant narratives. Sarah, hi, welcome. Hi. How's it going?
Hey, great. Hi. Thank you so much for having me and having Dad on today. We really appreciate it.
Amazing. And Thorne, you are currently working as a semi-retired HR consultant, and you've devoted pretty much your whole career to human resources and training and talent management, and are a longtime Long Islander. Both of you folks are from Long Island, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm. Moved here in 56.
Amazing. So we share that. Oh my gosh. Amazing. Well, we are fellow Islanders, so we share that. And I think there's a lot more kind of commonalities we can talk about. But, you know, both of you have a common story to share. And I think we're going to talk a lot about storytelling today. So in 2016, Sarah, you lost your mom to cancer, and Thorne, you lost your wife. And so, you know, the loss of a parent is such a significant and horrible and difficult and complicated experience, Sarah. I lost my father to cancer as well in 2018. So, wow. You know, on some level I can relate to the kind of, and you know, the complexities of losing a parent to cancer, particularly because it's just, you know, it's an arduous and really difficult and really sad process. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience? How did you guys find out about your mother's cancer? Just maybe if you could bring us through that a little bit.
Sure. So it was 2016. It was right around Halloween, and I was in New Orleans visiting my friend April, and Dad called me very early one morning, and Dad and I see each other a lot and we text a lot, but phone calls are rare. And it's, you know, Dad usually calls with serious news. So I already had a pit in my stomach when I saw his name on the phone at like 8 a.m. When I picked up the phone, he could barely speak. His voice was shaking, and he said, it's your mother. And then he said, they found a mass. And so I packed up my things, and he put Mom on the phone, and she was a little groggy, and it was hard to tell how serious it was. It was just like, you know, piecemeal kind of. So I basically got into a car and went to the airport and got on the first flight back and went straight to the airport. I went straight to the hospital, where I then realized that she had pain for a long time and finally went to get it checked out, and then was helicoptered to a different hospital, and things all happened very quickly from there. She was pretty quickly diagnosed with uterine cancer, and then we realized that it had metastasized. And it was pronounced stage 4, and, you know, it's a long story, but to make it short, between the time she was diagnosed, which was again, right before Halloween, to, the time that she died, which was December 26th, it was basically a 2-month process that was all up and down, all us hoping beyond hope that she was going to miraculously beat this. I went through all sorts of prayer and abstaining from everything you could think of and trying to make deals
bargaining
with God. And, you know, you know how things go. And so, you know, if you do this, God, I'll do this. And, you know, Dad and I at one point made a list of everyone who we loved who had died, and everyone who we had been friends with who had died. And I decided to call out to them by name every night And I think we had something like, oh my gosh, it was kind of fun to remember all these people on the other side.
Beautiful. You know? That's so beautiful.
Yeah. And I think we had like 55 people, something like a large number, a big crew. And it was so nice to remember how sweet all these folks were and how, and you know, their own stories. And anyway, so it was up and down and up and down and up and down. And we actually thought we were making progress and mom was in good spirits and she kept coming back from all of these incredible procedures and she was in good spirits. And then I think it was 2 days before Christmas, she had a scan and we realized that that the cancer had spread to her lungs and that it was, that there was no hope. And that was, those are the words that they used, you know, we have to prepare for her transition.
What a lot to take in a short amount of time.
It was, and you know, I have to, I work with the Moth and love the Moth. I've been there for almost 17 years and I took a leave of absence at the time and they were just incredible with me. You know, I just could never thank my colleagues enough. And I was with Dad every single day of those 2 months in the hospital. Every single day. And most of the time with Cameron, my brother, and most of the time also with Grandma Harriet, my mom's mom, and my mom's sister, Sharon, you know, we all took turns. But Dad and I we just stayed there with her until she died.
Sounds like you were conjuring up so much spirit by calling in all the people that had passed in your life. That really is a wonderful, incredible image of just calling in everybody to help support in this process. And
it's beautiful. And when you were saying that, I was actually thinking it prompted me to think about how there's all these kind of unexpected gifts in grief and in losing someone. And it's hard to think of it at the time. And maybe it's never easy to think of it or to realize it like that. But when you were kind of talking about, you know, calling back these folks in your life that you had known in their spirits, having this kind of spiritual experience, it really is like, you know, if your mother's passing hadn't occurred, that moment of touching base in that way would have also never occurred. And, you know, not to say one is worth the other, of course, but like there are these moments that we have in touching base with things we would never normally be able to. And I think that's an interesting thing about losing
gifts
someone.
And grief.
It's true. And I think, you know, I guess it depends a little bit on your spirituality and your religious beliefs, but to realize that there were so many people, I said, Dad, you know, who did we love? Who loved us? Who loved mom who's passed? And Dad came up with a whole list and I had a whole list of people I knew, but Dad, you know, had many decades more. And it's actually incredibly comforting to think of all the people who were just the best, just A+ folks who have died. And, you know, and to think that there's this, I don't want to call it like a net, but there's just this like cloud of love that, you know, you can't see. And I think that was really special. And now, you know, now that mom has been dead for almost 5 years now, and my grandmother Harriet has passed away and, you know, all four of my grandparents are dead. And so now, I mean, the number of folks on the other side is like massive. And so I keep joking with my family, like we have to repopulate, you know, we need some more on our team over here because we're getting pretty heavy on the other side.
Yeah. Thorne, what were some of the intricacies of the loss for you, of your wife? What were some of the things that maybe you remember about this time that felt significant or interesting or, you know, yeah, I just want to kind of gauge your perspective a little bit about what this time was like.
I mean, it was such a shock to realize how severely sick she was, to be told to take her to the emergency room. And then the day later, realized that she had to be flown by helicopter to the Southside Hospital in Bay Shore. It was shocking. It was too much to comprehend, and yet still want to care for her and offer her the sensitivities of, if it's a shock for me, imagine how much of a shock it was for Maureen. So she chose not to deal with it for her own reasons. But she admitted to me later that she never realized that it was as severe as it turned out to be. So while I overheard her talk to her girlfriend and say, I'm going to pack my suitcase and take it to the hospital with me, I never thought that she would never come home. It was just unbelievable. But to go back to the losses in the family, I think most of the losses that we've experienced and the friends of the family were people who have lived a rather full life and have died over a long period of time. The shock of this happening in 2 months' time was hard to wrap your arms around. It was we were looking for anything to give us hope and comfort, and we couldn't find it. That's why I think Sarah and I just developed a very, very close relationship by, you know, being the best that we could offer Maureen.
Yeah. You're really describing the definition of trauma, because it means more than we can handle. And, you know, for everything to happen so quickly and unexpectedly, and, you know, it wasn't anything that you had ever conceived of. And then it all to come down on you in that short amount of time was traumatic. So it's this different, the grief and the trauma, we like to look at as differently in a way. And grief is such a natural process, and trauma is something that's, you know, just a profound shock.
Yeah.
It's also an interesting kind of thing. And I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I think a lot of times, you know, when people have terminal illness, you have maybe more time, you know, you find out, and then there's something in that of getting to say goodbye and kind of come to terms with it over maybe a more extended period of time. Then there's often losses that happen suddenly by accident or sudden tragedy. And those are like, you know, so quickly that you're forced to, you're thrust right in to kind of deal with it. So it's a very interesting and I would assume a very complicated kind of situation when someone dies quickly of a terminal illness, and you're kind of left, it seems to me, in kind of a limbo between, you know, the immediate kind of being able to deal with it and also having the kind of prolonged, like semi-prolonged state. Did it feel complicated for you, Sarah, in that way? Like, did it feel...
Yeah, well, I mean, at first, her surgeon kept talking, her oncologist at Southside kept talking about the bagel ladies, which we came to just hate. Dad, I'm speaking, I don't know how you felt about it, but it was these bagel ladies. I mean, I didn't hate the, I love the bagel ladies, but the bagel ladies were the ladies who made it through stage four somehow, miraculously. They're right. Still alive. They're still kicking. They're still, you know, they're still miraculously, and God love them, and, you know, enjoying their lives. And they get together and they all have bagels together. This is why he calls them the bagels.
I forgot that, Sarah.
And so he kept telling Mom, oh, don't worry, you're going to be a bagel lady. And he was telling us, like, you know, because my mother was feisty is not even the right word. She was a pillar. She was so
fighter.
Strong.
Yeah.
You know, she was just, people revered her and were scared of her. You know, I mean, she was like a titan. She was a lioness. You know, she was just had a very big personality and was so loving and generous that when this oncologist was talking, was referring to her as the bagel lady, you know, in my heart, I thought, well, there's actually a chance that she will be, because she is such a strong person. And she was quite religious, and she had, you know, she, it felt like she was from another world to begin with. So it felt like, okay, maybe this will work out, that she'll have another 5 years, you know, that she'll have another, who knows how long.
And there were two or three times where she had to go through procedures, and the doctors were saying they didn't think that she would be able to survive these procedures. And she kept generating hope by surviving and living another day. She was in ICU for four different times. We got to know the ICU nurses and doctors so well, we gave them Christmas cards. And they hung up Christmas cards of the family. It was bizarre. I mean, we kept holding out hope for anything that could allow her to live another day. And she kept surprising all of us. So it was to imagine that it all lasted 60 days or so is amazing. We went through hell many times.
Yeah. Hell and hope. And to answer your question, we didn't have any idea how long she would live. We hoped for the best. We hoped she, you know, would have still been here with us now, but in finality, the scans came back from a different floor and it was basically all over. And I remember we got Elliot on the phone and they were FaceTiming. It was like, I think that was probably the most traumatic part.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that, like, it was a matter of hours, you know, and she stayed alive. You know, we laugh and we thank her, because I do think that people can choose when, you know, if you're in a prolonged state like that, you who knows, but I think you may be able to choose when you die, whether you're dying, you know, alone, when people, you know, you hear people left to go to the bathroom and that's mm-hmm. when mom died, or people,
right.
or she waited until everyone was here with her and then she died, you know? And so do you want to do it privately or publicly? And who knows whether you really have control over that? I like to think that you do, but mom, she wouldn't die on Christmas. You know, she was in such dire straits and in such pain, but I think she just, like, you know, refused to do it because it, you know, Christmas would have just been horrendous for us for the rest of our lives, you know? And so she just toughed it through and died around 11 o'clock the next day.
Was there ever a time that you talked with her about her dying? Was there ever a time that she looked to you guys and said, you know, I know this is happening?
Oddly enough, I don't think we ever did. It was staring us in the face so distinctly that it was something that I couldn't openly talk about. We know that she passed on her regards to cleaning ladies that we've had in the house. They asked if they could come visit Maureen and their sisters, and they saw Maureen, and Maureen said, you take care of Thorne. You know, he's going to need you.
So that was her way of saying it, yeah.
Yeah, so she still was resilient up to the last moment. When we realized that she had to start the morphine drip, Sarah and I went home that night before they started it, and we said, we have a short period of time in which we have to either ask Maureen questions or make statements or make decisions, because we're not going to have a chance to do it once the morphine begins. And so we wrote out a couple questions, and that was probably the most serious moment for us, that it was inevitable. There was nothing we could do to stop it.
You know, this happens in so many families. It's not easy to talk about death and dying. It's not easy to talk at all. And so I just, you know, I wonder if that was hard for either one of you to not talk about it. It's hard to talk about it. And it's hard to not talk about it. Right.
So I don't think that mom real, I don't, I, who knows what she realized, but I, we didn't quite know that she was definitely dying until 2 days before she died. Mm-hmm. It was always the hope. Mm-hmm. And then when it was finally pronounced, like, there is no possible way, 0% chance that she will live, and we have to start the morphine drip, and we're going to give her maybe a day to 3 days. That's when, as Dad said, we talked to her about where she would be buried. You know, we said, we would like to bury you in the Jeunesse family plot in Rye. And she smiled and nodded and said, okay. But she was so, like, graceful.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like, steadfast and not stubborn, but just kind of, like, graceful about it. Like, it's almost like she had just accepted it. Like, she wasn't teary. She was just, like, almost blissed out in this way. I mean, she wasn't smiling and happy about it, clearly.
Of course,
you know, but there was nothing we could do. Mm-hmm. And then Dad said, you know, we want to start a scholarship in your name. And then we asked, would you like it to be for the orchestral students or also the band students? And Mom thought for a minute and she said, just orchestra. Oh. And we laughed about that because, you know, that is so her. And then we knew that one night was, like, the last night that people could say goodbye to her or pass along the respect. So my best friend Erin came and said, you know, what do you even say in that moment? So I think she just said, you know, I love you and I'm wishing you well, or, you know, God. And
the grandkids had a chance to sit on her lap on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Aww. That was touching.
Oh, yeah. That's... And Christmas Day, there were some presents there. But I think earlier in this, like maybe halfway through the first month in, Mom and I were alone in one of the rooms that she was in. And she, out of nowhere, she said, I'm sorry, Sarah. I don't know how or why this happened.
Mm.
And that was, and then I was just kind of silent. I was silent. You know, because she had never apologized for anything ever.
Totally out of character.
You know, just to be honest with you, so I knew something was terribly wrong. but there was just nothing to, at that point, there was just nothing to say. I think I just held her hand. I don't even think I said anything because it was just so much.
I mean, the odd thing was that she was in so many different rooms in the hospital during that 60-day period of time. She must have been in six different rooms. They kept moving her around. She got to meet most of the nurses, the oncologist and his team of doctors came in several times each day. He turned out to be a Dartmouth graduate as well as me, and that was part of the reason why Maureen chose him. He came in on the very first day and he had to make a pitch to Maureen as to why she wanted to use him as her oncologist rather than going to Memorial Sloan Kettering. And so she looked at him and she said one thing. She said, "Wahoo wah," which is an old motto of Dartmouth alumni representing the relationship with the American Indian.
Which is the New Hampshire connection, right? That's the New Hampshire connection because, as you said, you've had how many generations of your family have lived in
Hampshire? I'm the 10th generation. Sarah and Cameron are the 11th, and our grandkids are the 12th generation from 1624 or something like that.
Wow.
I mean, it goes way, way back.
Yeah. And I want to comment when you were talking about your mom, Sarah, and she said, I'm sorry. You know, we were talking about stories before the show started, and I guess stories can be in a few words, right? A few words can tell a whole story. It was so beautiful. So what happened after that? You mentioned that it was the day after Christmas and that you were going to New Hampshire. Is that where you had the funeral service in New Hampshire?
No, we had it down here in Huntington at St. Patrick's January 6th, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we needed to take some time and grieve. So we had a three-step process. We had the funeral service at St. Pat's on the 6th. We had a party at Crewe following it, and it snowed, which was fitting.
Mm-hmm. It was so
everybody
pretty.
Had to get home in the snow and go on with their lives. And then we had what did we have, Sarah? We had the burial in June in the Rye. So it was a very extended grieving period, but we had to grieve two or three different times.
Mm-hmm. And tell us more about the scholarship, because that's so incredible that those were the last few things that you talked about. Tell us more about that.
I don't think we had ever talked about it, but it was one of the things that I think Sarah and I agreed to when we were home that night and saying, how can we continue Mom's memory? To this day, I don't know that half of the students that she had, I mean, she taught for 30 years, and usually orchestras have as many as 100 kids in the orchestra. She also had a chamber ensemble, which is much smaller, but she rubbed elbows with so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids, thousands of kids. And to this day, I'm not sure that as many of them are aware that she's no longer here. And so one of the ways to continue her name in perpetuity is to continue to honor her name. So I reached out to the school system and said, I would like to set up a scholarship. What do I need to do? And they said, you need to put together a proposal. We need to better understand who this person is. And I said, she's been your sidekick for 30 years. What do you, I mean, you should be naming a school after her, or at least an auditorium, right. You know? And so I had to pitch that. And then I had to determine what's the reasonable amount. This was an LLC, so it had to be a legal entity. It had to be a, you know, 501c3 organization. There was an awful lot that had to be done to just set it up. The funny thing about it was that the first time we had to choose a deserving senior to win the award, it turns out that the winning senior happened to be the daughter of one of Maureen's former violin students, going way, wow, way back.
How special is that generation?
And,
beautiful.
And so the joke was, come on, Maureen, you know, stop playing around. Stop managing your life.
I take it that she played around. She had a sense of humor, I take it. Maureen.
She did.
Yes.
Oh, she did. She loved pulling surprises and making people laugh and laughing at her with her at the same time. So we've done it 5 times. I've now, Sarah and I have helped declutter several rooms in the house, and one of them was Maureen's office. It's where she had all her things. And I found so many mementos, mm-hmm, that deserve to be in the school, mm-hmm, rather than at home, that I reached out to the current orchestra director and said, can I make a donation? Can I give you the scores of all of her music library? Can I give you practice books for all the different musical groups that she had to coach? And so he was nice enough to say, I'll take anything you want to give. So that'll continue Maureen's memory as well.
Beautiful.
You know, my brother Cameron and I we grew up going to rehearsals with Mom. So we grew up in the Walt Whitman rehearsal rooms, hearing classical music, you know, and I think part of my love of, or feeling so comfortable in the theater and on stage on the, you know, in the theatrical arts side, you know, comes from my mother, mm, bringing me through, you know, stage with her chamber ensemble and her various orchestras. And she used to have everybody to our backyard for barbecues, mm-hmm, when we were younger. Mm-hmm. And so to honor her with a scholarship, mm, for those students, mm-hmm, who love music, it just made so much sense. I think it came to Dad and to me in a fit of what do we do? And it was almost divine. Like it was right there in front of us. And we came in the next morning before, you know, while Mom was still conscious, and it was so nice. But it feels like home to walk into the backyard and see current students, just like we did when my brother and I were young.
Beautiful. So many people want to do that and never get the chance to do that. You know, they want to, it's a dream. You've done it for 5 years now, 4 years now. That's really incredible. Yeah. I understand Maureen liked to cook too, that Mom liked to cook.
She was a great cook. She was a risk taker. She would invite people over and then seriously contemplate, what can I do that'll kind of be the perfect dinner plan? And more often than not, she would cook something for the very first time and take risks associated with it. And more times than not, it would be a splendid success. And that's part of the challenge that I now find in the kitchen. Nobody's cooking for me. I got to cook for myself. And I've limited myself to only one meal out of the kitchen a week, whether that's a fast food, which I hardly ever do, or a dinner like I had last night with Alan and a couple friends. So, you know, it's it puts me back in her world. You know, I'm not the risk taker. I don't think, and yet Sarah would probably argue with that. I do. Sarah and I have a game, and it's Maureen has 3 or 4 shelves of cookbooks in the kitchen. Hundreds, I would say. I would say more than half of which probably have never been opened and never been used. I don't see markings. I don't see pages earmarked. I don't see any scribbling. Sometimes she wrote whether or not the recipe was good or not and when it was cooked. So I've tried continuing in that tradition. But Sarah picks a cookbook off the shelf. I then choose a recipe in it, and Sarah, knowing where the cookbook is coming from, has to choose a video that we're going to watch while the dinner is being served.
And I love
and
that.
And we've done it four amazing. Different times. It's amazing. I mean, it challenges.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So give us an example.
Me.
Give us an example. I'm curious.
Go ahead,
okay,
Sarah.
Well, the first one. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, you know, Mom left behind so many things. And like Dad said, some of the cookbooks have never been used, but some of the cookbooks have been used so much that there are all sorts of markings in them. And then she had other recipes that she wrote on index cards. And so Mom has just tons and tons and tons of recipes around. So we said, what are we going to do with all these books? And I picked this first cookbook to try this, you know, special night, a cookbook from the South. It was like the Savannah cookbook. And Dad picked a recipe, and then we watched The Prince of Tides.
Oh, my goodness. Barbara Streisand.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
And Nick Nolte, The Low Country.
I recently watched that
myself. Spinach salad. And Dad, I forget what was it? Spinach salad and like scallops or something like
that?
No, this?
I think it was shrimp scampi.
Oh, yes. Shrimp scampi.
And a spinach salad.
And a spinach salad.
How fun.
And then we thought this was terrific. And it felt like such a way to honor some of the Mom's love of cooking, some of the cookbooks that were just sitting there. And then we wanted to do it again. So the next one was a cookbook from New England.
It
and
was
we
Sopranos.
Watched,
it was the Sopranos cookbook.
That's
fun. The Sopranos cookbook. So the next was the Sopranos cookbook. And we watched two episodes of the Sopranos and had an Italian dish. Another one was the New England cookbook, and we watched The Departed. And then the last one was a beautiful French cookbook, and we watched Charade with Audrey Hepburn.
Oh my gosh, you just watched that,
I just
right,
watched
Kathy?
That movie too, loved it so much.
Yeah.
That's
no,
so wonderful.
Great.
I think you've started
great.
a new game for families. I mean, this is so inspiring.
Beautiful.
Really.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting, Sarah, because obviously so much of your life's work has been dedicated to storytelling. And it's something that I think we want to kind of touch on too before we end the episode. But, you know, cooking is also kind of a form of storytelling, especially when it comes to passed down recipes. It's a way of continuing a bond with people who we lost. And in that, you kind of, I think, are conjuring these memories of folks. What was it like when they made this? What was it like when they were in the kitchen? And kind of reliving these, you know, very personal stories and personal experiences that we have with them. And I personally think that there's something in recreating a dish or using somebody's cookbook. Or, you know, Thorne, how you were talking about, you know, cooking for yourself is kind of your way and continuing a bond with Maureen. I just think it's interesting, Sarah, as someone whose life's work is based in storytelling and based around storytelling, how do you feel about cooking as a form of storytelling?
Well, I think to tell a story about any experience, you need an angle in. So I like to say that moth stories are like short documentaries. You know, you can't tell your whole story, you can't tell your whole life story. You have to pick and choose which experiences you want to mine for meaning. And I think that cooking food or sharing a meal is such an excellent way into relationship. We've had a lot of stories at the Moth that center around food, center around a recipe. Some stories that I can remember include a specific recipe or the memory of a loved one cooking a recipe as a beautiful detail that they use in order to build the character. So I think that food is a fertile ground for remembering people and, coming up with the memories that you could build a story around.
Yeah. You know, before the show, we were chatting with you about kind of, and I know Bobby, we had discussed earlier in discussing this episode, the importance of storytelling when it comes to remembering a loved one who passed away. And also that sometimes that is quite painful for people, that the actual retelling of the story can, you know, Sarah, you had mentioned before the show, sometimes folks, you know, are unable to even get through their own story. It's difficult. It's challenging at different stages of the grieving process, at different stages of processing, and just depending on who you are as a person and how close you are willing to get to, you know, the grief in a public way. I think that personally, that sometimes cooking, and it could be cooking, it could be woodworking, it could be a walk in the woods, anything that kind of is, you know, an alternate way of storytelling can sometimes be a way into touching upon that, even if it's too hard to repeat it verbally, you know, even if you're not ready to talk about it yet. There's something in like accessing your story through, you know, reliving some of these things that were really important that you shared with the person, or that really kind of represented who they were. And in fact, you know, part of the reason that we even started this podcast and kind of talked about it tied to food, you know, the intersection of food and grief, is because sometimes it is so deeply painful to access those memories, or it's a societal taboo that maybe we're not supposed to talk about grief or death, or it seems, you know, too dark or too upsetting to talk about. And so, I don't know, I'm always kind of interested by the ways in which people can tap into their grief and tell that story, perhaps even if it's not verbal.
Well, I have a few thoughts. Yeah. If you're grieving and you feel you can't talk about the person, how nice to create a recipe that they loved. How nice to go to that restaurant that they loved and order the dish that they loved. And, you know, in doing that, it's honoring the person. It's an experience of being close to them. In addition to that, when you're telling stories about loved ones who have passed away, I think there are a few different ways that you can honor the memory of a loved one. One is to tell stories about them in the everyday. So Dad and I tell stories about Mom to each other. We tell stories about Mom to Cameron's children. They talk about her regularly. That's something Grandma Maureen would have liked, or tell us more about Grandma Maureen, or, you know, we bring up all sorts of things that we remember about Halloween nights and what she used to dress up as, mm-hmm. and, you know, moments where Cameron and I were off with toilet paper and she had to go back to the police department and ask for it back because we were out of toilet paper, whatever it is that comes up, you know, and we laugh yeah. about it. And it's a way to really honor her, in a very everyday kind of more normal way. In my work with the moth, I've seen over and over people want to tell stories of loved ones who have passed away. In some cases, they want to take the stage and tell the story right after the passing. And you run a risk when you are doing that, because it is possible that your grief is not processed. It's probable that your grief is not processed. And so the risk that you're running mm-hmm. is that when you're up on stage, it becomes more of a session, like a therapy session, where you're actively working through it. And to be honest, that's not exactly what the audience came to see. Mm-hmm. You know, you need some reflection exactly. and time that has passed since the events that you're talking about to turn the events into the art of story. So when we're working with people on a Moth main stage story, which is the directed series, the stories that are 10 to 12 minutes long that you hear the bulk of on the Moth Radio Hour and the podcast, those stories have been directed by somebody in tandem with the storyteller. And what the director is really looking for is, can we contextualize this relationship that you had with the person? Can we find an arc for you, the storyteller, so that it is about your relationship with that person? And is there a place where we can end the story that really resolves the story, that really makes the story, your story, make sense? Because if the grief is not processed to some degree, we've seen storytellers stand on stage and not be able to get to their ending because they're so happy that they've conjured this loved one in front of hundreds of people. And there's a beauty in having those hundreds of people meet your mother or meet your best friend or meet your spouse. But then in the story, we see you realize, oh God, I have to acknowledge that this person has died. And I have to acknowledge it in front of these hundreds of folks. And it can be uncomfortable to, and oh gosh, as a director, you just want to hug the person, run up on stage and hug them. But we say that, it could be 1 year that you need mm-hmm. for some mm-hmm. distance. It could be 5 years. And some people are just not ready in a public forum to tell a story of someone they deeply loved who's passed because it's just too painful. In other cases, 6 months passes and they can find an entry point and an exit point so that they can tell a beautiful story that really is cohesive and makes sense and honors the person, but that feels healing instead of like they're still processing.
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking as you were talking, and this relates to you, Thorne, that group sessions for bereavement are very helpful because you really do get to tell your story in many different ways. I used to work at hospice and I ran bereavement support groups there. And in the beginning, we would always have people go around first and tell their story. And then the second week, we would have them bring things that were represented their loved one. So it was another way of telling their story. And we would have, it was really about storytelling. So I wonder, Thorne, I know you had participated in a support group. Did you find that that was a good way of telling your story in public in front of other people who could, intimately share the story of Maureen?
It was wonderful. I had also experienced one at Huntington Hospital. But what was different about the two is that in the Huntington Hospital, these were people who had just suffered a loss. There was no connection between one person who was there and another. I was there because my spouse died. Another was there because her son died of a drug overdose. Another one, her husband died in a terrible car accident. So the circumstances didn't help bring us closer together. And the second one I went to, nine people, all of whom lost their spouses to a different form of cancer on Long Island. And so it was jarring to hear other people's stories, the pain, the suffering, the shock that they went through. It normalized it for me. I went in thinking, how could anybody deal with losing a spouse in 2 months' time? It was record-setting in some respects. But in many ways, I didn't think Maureen or we suffered nearly as much as people who fought breast cancer four different times before the wife died on the fourth round. That's over 3 years. So it puts it in perspective. You can accept the finality of it a lot better, but it also caused the group to become best friends with each other. Mm-hmm. We've now, and Bobby keeps saying, I can't believe that going on 4.5 years, you meet every month for dinner out. You just share a love for each other and what they've had to go through to survive.
You become part of each other's story now.
Yeah, yeah. It's a new thing. Family yes. of sorts.
Yeah.
The thing that strikes me, I think, so much about storytelling is that, and again, Sarah, you had kind of touched on this a bit when we were just chatting before we recorded, is that, I feel like as human beings, everyone's life has a very different and very complex very personal struggle, right? We all have these things that we deal with no matter what they are, no matter who we are, no matter where we live, what's happened to us. And I think that the thing that can really keep people in a dark place sometimes is feeling unseen. We all kind of want to feel seen. And then the value of feeling seen and the value of feeling heard and the value of feeling like, my story represents me, and that if I can share my story and if someone understands my story, that like makes me feel, seen and heard and how important that is. And additionally, Thorne, to your point, hearing other people's stories can make us feel less alone. Yeah. I mean, and it doesn't take away the individuality and how complex each of our losses or each of our experiences are so unique to us. But to know that you're not alone with pain and with grief especially is important. And I just think that, the profoundness of giving people the opportunity to share their stories is really huge and is so kind of, just important and impactful in terms of like the grieving process in general. I think like being able to offer a way where people can, let that into the world. And Sarah, in your line of work, like giving people this platform and opportunity to do so is so generous and so
really huge. It helps our human condition. as a total.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for saying that. I've been with the Moth for almost 17 years and I love it. The art of storytelling is such a, it's a gift the storyteller gives to the audience. But then I like to say that the Moth looks like a storytelling organization, and it is, but it is really a place that invites people to practice the art of listening. And I think that's what you're saying, that in this day and age, it is quite rare for people to be able to tell of themselves, of a life, real life experience that changed them, and be uninterrupted for a handful of minutes. And so, you know, in non-pandemic times, the Moth has 600 live events a year. Some of those are very small scale and open mic, and some of those are much larger theaters. But in every case, a single person who you may sit next to on a bus or in an airplane or stand next to online in a grocery store is telling a crafted story of something that fundamentally change them. And grief and loss is fortunately, unfortunately, just a part of life. And so it shows up in a lot of Moth stories. And sometimes it's the kickoff. We say, like, sometimes it's the inciting incident. Sometimes the loss is what starts your story. Mm-hmm. You know, you're beginning with the end of one story is the beginning of another. Beautiful. So the passing of a loved one could kick off a brand new chapter for you, and does. Mm-hmm. And in some cases the death comes at the end of someone's story, and it's after a long battle, or it's a shock. But death death is present in many Moth stories, as I'm sure the listeners know. Mm.
You know, it's interesting because I think that when we're in times of grief, whether it be heartbreak, whether it be loss, whether it be any kind of, you know, just really upsetting situation, there is this feeling, at least I know I've had it, and I'm assuming most other people have, that no one can possibly understand what I'm going through. No one has ever felt this before. And I think that that is both true and untrue at the same time. You know what I mean? It's true because you are a unique human being, and, you know, the kind of bizarre complexities of what makes up people and what makes up their specific feelings and everything is, it can't be matched, right? It's like a fingerprint. But at the same time, it's untrue because we all have the kind of this common bond in that, like, strife affects each one of us, trauma, grief, pain, like it all, joy, you know what I mean? Pleasure, like all these things kind of touch everyone in their lives in the same way. And so I think the one of the most wonderful things about any platform, particularly the Moth, which is so incredible, but support groups, AA, you know, different podcasts, documentaries, filmmaking, yeah, really art, recipes, like it's about like kind of this human connectivity. And when we can get those little tiny breakthroughs of light to be like, I am not the actual only person that has ever felt this pain or this joy. And that is comforting in some way, at least to me.
And as we always say on the show, the courage to reveal yourself. It takes great courage because it seems so much easier to just hold it in. You know, although I always think of this quote that Maya Angelou had. She said, "There's no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside of yourself."
Oh, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Incredible. I think the courage to share... The courage to share your stories, plural, and the courage to listen to other stories makes life less scary. I mean, I don't think that death is not talked about as much as it should be, in my opinion. It is still quite taboo. It is something that we will all experience, and if it were part of our everyday. I mean, not in a super dark way, but just, you know, acknowledged, named. It doesn't take on the weight that I think that it's not as scary as or as untouchable, you know, as some people believe it to be.
Absolutely. I have a question for both of you, Sarah and Thorne, since we do love to talk about food on this show. And you've mentioned that Maureen was such a wonderful cook and had so many cookbooks. I'm wondering if either of you, you know, individually or together, if maybe there's something that was just kind of so important in the family, in her cooking. But is there a dish or a kind of food experience or a holiday that really reminds you of Maureen and her cooking? And
well, her favorite holiday was Thanksgiving. We had Thanksgiving at our house so often that I put together a photo book for the family members. And it spanned, what, Sarah, 20 years maybe?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You saw kids who were quite young in the beginning, and then at the end of the book, they were married. They had children.
You can chart relationships by the photographs.
Yeah.
This is when they first met. This is when they got married. This is when they had their kids.
And so, awesome. You know, she, I think we went 18 years. I've been in the house 34 years. We went 18 years without fixing up and upgrading the kitchen. So when we finally remodeled the kitchen, Maureen all of a sudden became the expert party planner, because she had double ovens, she had cooktops, she could do the things that she always dreamed of doing. And so that just added to the joy of holding these parties. The house is a great house for having, I mean, it's a very large dining room now that we've moved it to what used to be the living room. And she had this huge table, was a takeoff on, you know, the antique tables of old. And she just loved putting on parties.
It's nice to break out all of her accoutrements and cooking utensils and plates. And it feels very celebratory to go into those cabinets and unearth everything. When
and
I was
all
younger,
the china
she...
and all the silver that gets hidden away immediately after the party.
When I was younger, I remember her making stuffed peppers a lot. She would make stuffed peppers for us. One of her favorite dishes to order out was bolognese. And so when we are out, many times we'll order that in honor of Mom. She made all sorts of, she was excellent with her sauces. She would make all sorts of delicious sauces. And yeah, I mean, everything that she created, she would bake. She would bake for her chamber ensemble. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting in the car always with big baskets full of brownies and homemade cookies. And so I knew that it was a night she'd go to her chamber ensemble, because the whole house always smelled like delicious sweets. And yeah. So, I mean, anytime we're in the kitchen or we're making something with love, I think we're really channeling her.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So, you know, at the end of each episode, we kind of always like to ask everyone the same question, and everyone's answers are always so different and so interesting. But I'm going to ask it to both of you. And that is, if you could have given yourself one piece of advice at the beginning of this grieving experience, kind of knowing what you know now, having processed your feelings and kind of, you know, gone through the grieving process, do you have any advice that you would give to your younger self, kind of just beginning on this journey? Sarah, we can start with you.
I would have hugged myself and said, take a deep breath and it'll all be okay. And just like Mom told you before she died, she's always watching.
When you wrote that in your pre-interview, I was reading it and I really, really got me. I really became very emotional, and it's so sweet and such a wonderful thought to think about her watching and being there. It's really beautiful.
Well, that's what's so much fun of hearing the stories from Sarah and Cameron of conversations that they had with Maureen when I wasn't there. So it's almost like, it's almost like opening up a whole new chapter in better understanding and appreciating the relationship between mom and children, rather than just, you know, spouses talking together. We had a very challenging lives together, two different, distinctly different chapters, with two wonderful children to show for it. But if there was anything that I would say to my, older self, it would be, stop feeling as if you could have done something differently to lessen the pain and the suffering that she went through. Sorry.
Oh, no.
and learn from it, you know? It's quite a stimulating experience when it all gets broken down. So in some ways, it's been very worthwhile. I hate to say it that way, but not to see her go, but it's opened up a whole new awareness to me, and I think to the kids, in terms of what is life mean to us now.
Well, we were very close before, but now that she's passed, I think we're, you know, death brings people together. I mean, we were an incredibly tight-knit family before she passed, but now we're pretty inseparable.
I just want to thank you guys. I mean, we have one more thing that we like to talk about at the end of the show, but I just want to take this opportunity to, like, not just say thank you for joining us, but deeply, because to come on this show and to go to tell these stories is, I always really think of it as being so deeply generous. It's such a, like, generosity of spirit. It's a heavy lift emotionally, you know, because it's not just the hour that we spend together talking about these really kind of very vulnerable, very, you know, hard to think about memories and times, but it's thinking about before the episode. It's the days that follow. It's the re-listening of it. So it's like really, you know, unearthing some big feelings, even if they are feelings you've processed, even if these are stories you've told, you know, even if your career is in storytelling, to tell your own story publicly is a really heavy lift. And it is so, we appreciate it so much, that generosity. And we know that our listeners appreciate it so much. And there are people at all different stages of the grieving process who tune in to listen to this for guidance, for feeling togetherness, for feeling kind of like there are comrades in this, you know, situation with Sarah, as you mentioned, we talk about often in a death denying kind of culture, and where death still is such a taboo. It feels, you know, one of our goals with the show is to destigmatize grieving and death and everything that goes along with it. And so this is all to say that in the heavy lift that you've done emotionally for today, we thank you so much, because it really does mean so much to other folks who feel like they're aliens in this process, especially at the beginning, you know, and you don't know if you're supposed to feel this way, or if it's okay, or if anyone else does. And again, yes, other people do and they don't, you know, it's just, so thank you deeply from the bottom of our hearts for taking the time and for taking you know, the space to share with us today something that is so, you know, really tender and dear to you and so personal.
Well, thank you for asking us to help.
I think you too for this beautiful podcast and for talking about death and grief and normalizing it. And I also thank you for inviting us to Conjure Mom back for a little bit, Maureen. She, you know, it's nice to talk about her and to honor her and to remember her. So we thank you so much.
And we really all learned about her, and the listeners have learned about her too. You know, your warmth is so palpable, and it really it invites us to think it would be nice if we could continue this today, and if we could have a feast together. What would we bring to the feast? So if we could sit at that wonderful table in your dining room, Thorne, the one that Maureen loves so much, and we could sit down and have a meal together, what would we all bring?
I would cook a turkey.
Okay.
Just like,
yeah,
I would do out on the Weber grill for Thanksgiving.
Ooh.
Maureen would make sweet potato and sausage casserole.
Ooh.
She would make spinach. No, broccoli casserole and shortbread. What else, Sarah?
She'd make beets for me, which I would appreciate greatly.
Yum.
Right. And a nice salad.
A very nice salad. I would probably make stuffed peppers in honor of her. She loved an eclectic dinner, a hearty dinner that was eclectic and filled with lots of comfort food.
Oh, good. You know, interestingly enough, my friends have a farm, and I went to there last week, and I brought a bunch of peppers. They gave me a big basket full of peppers, and Zara made me stuffed peppers this week. She came out from Brooklyn and made me stuffed peppers, so it's interesting you're talking about that.
Really?
So you'd bring stuffed peppers, and
oh,
I would bring mushrooms.
That's
I would
so
bring
nice.
Mushroom strudel. Because my mom was Hungarian, and she taught me how to make strudel when I was a young child.
Nice.
It's the first thing she taught me how to make. But I would make mushroom strudel. I would get all kinds of interesting mushrooms and creamy filling, and I'd make a nice flaky strudel. What would you make, Zaz?
Well, because we're talking about, we talked about cookbooks and Maureen's love of cookbooks and your guys' amazing, by the way, amazing and beautiful and sweet tradition that you have to with the cookbooks. I love it so much. It's really, really amazing. My dad's favorite cookbook, my dad was a chef and a baker, and he had lots of beautiful cookbooks. And some of them actually, funnily enough, are covered in cake batter. So I know the recipes that he really loved have like 40-year-old cake batter, like just crunched on. And people have asked, you know, the question, you know, if you had to grab something from your house, if you could only take one thing, like it would be these cookbooks that are crusted in cake batter. So one of his cookbooks that's the most crusty and covered in like in cake batter is Maida Haida's book about cakes. She's a wonderful, prolific cookbook writer. And his favorite recipe in there was her carrot cake. Mm. And so the carrot cake page is illegible. You cannot read it, but you can kind of get the recipe online now, but it's just covered in carrot cake. That's all to say I would make my dad / Maida Haida's carrot cake.
Okay. Oh, that's incredible. That's incredible. What a beautiful image.
Yeah, it's cool. Well, Bobby and my dad used to own the Love and Oven, and they had the specialty takeout food shop, and they made all these beautiful things. And so that's some Love and Oven cake batter. It definitely puts a timestamp on it. So that's like 70s cake batter right there.
So great.
Well, you guys, this was really beautiful. And Sarah, can you just tell our guests, our listeners, how we can listen to the Moth Radio Hour and just a little bit about the Moth so we can all be tuning in?
Sure. Oh, I'm so excited too. So the Moth has a radio program and the Moth podcast. You can find the Moth podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts. For more information on when the Moth Radio Hour is airing on public radio in your neck of the woods, you can go to themoth.org. And I have some exciting news, and that is my colleagues and I have been writing a book, and the book is called How to Tell a Story, The Essential Guide to Memorable Storytelling from the Moth. And it comes out in April. And so if you want to purchase it and read it, you can also find information on our website with / How to Tell a Story. It's all about how to find a craft and share your own personal stories out into the world, which is what we need now more than ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really amazing. And I'm so glad that we just got to have your perspective on storytelling and the kind of importance of storytelling. We couldn't possibly have a better expert when it comes to storytelling. And when you say it's more important now than ever, it is so true, because we are all like, you know, kind of more in our own worlds than ever. And there's so many reasons to share our stories now. We cannot wait for that book. That is amazing. And we love the Moth. And really, to both of you guys, as a team, to come on and be able to talk about this together, it's really special. It was really, really special.
I appreciate you too. And Dad, I appreciate you. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. In Wisconsin, cheese is our thing. Wisconsin is the only state in the country that requires a license to make cheese. From curds to cheddar, blue to brick, Wisconsin cheesemakers can do it all. We blend tradition with innovation to create an incredible variety of cheeses that you just can't get anywhere else. You've heard of a PhD, but have you heard of a PH cheese? Otherwise known as the Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker Program. This rigorous study of cheese is an elite accomplishment earned by only 80 talented cheesemakers in Wisconsin, and the program is only one of two in the world. Becoming a master cheesemaker takes 13 years and is basically like a doctorate in a specific variety of cheese, with intense requirements to succeed. Our Master Cheesemaker Program allows makers to perfect both the art and science of their craft in a tradition so rich you can taste it. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com. Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.